call it a risk. Send lawyers, guns and money. Dad, get me out of this. Ha!
Welcome everybody to episode 80 of the Matt Jones podcast here on a Monday. We're taping this just so you know. Monday about 3 o'clock. I'll say that because a lot of this information we're going to give you is about the election, which is tomorrow on Tuesday. So some of you listen to this over the course of 2 or 3 days. And if anything we say sounds stupid, you can just blame it on the fact that it was Monday at about 3 o'clock. But I'm joined by Joe Sonka, who is a writer for the Courier Journal and also a Pulitzer Prize winner, which is a new thing. And Joe, let me start by congratulating you. You know, for people in your field, there is no bigger honor than winning the Pulitzer Prize. What did that mean to you when you got it?
Still hasn't really sunk in on me that that actually happened. But maybe a couple of years from now, it'll sink in on me. But it was pretty mind-blowing.
Well, surprising. I mean, listen, it was for the Matt Bevin pardon stuff, right?
Yes, which was all the more interesting based on what he told them. What he told me about winning a Pulitzer.
Well, no, tell that story. That's a great story. So you initially, the story comes out, Matt Bevin has given pardons and some of them have gone to people who are, you know, donors. And it was controversial. And then he called you and what did he say?
So of course, this is like 3 or 4 days after we first start running these pardon stories and they're running every day on the front page. And of course, Matt Bevin made a point of not speaking to me and not answering any questions for a year. So the thought that he would just call me out of the blue and talk to me for an hour was just, I just couldn't really believe it. It's a long story if you want to hear the whole thing.
The quote. I really wanted the quote.
Sure. Well, he called me and he talked to me for an hour. He was surprisingly civil. He didn't call me names. He didn't like do all the things you usually see him do with reporters until the very end. And of course he's defending all of his pardons and saying all these people are completely innocent. They were railroaded and there's all this corruption. And he gets to the end and he says, like, I tell you what, if you really dig into my pardons, dig into each and every one of them, look into them, I'm telling you, you can win a Pulitzer Prize. Then he goes, well, maybe not you, but someone who was good at writing and researching.
What a jerk statement. Like, that's so him, though, just to, like, like that and then just be a jerk, yeah.
Yeah, which was, like, he held out for almost an entire hour, and then he just couldn't help himself with that last one.
That's funny. Well, you did win, and so for people who don't know, Joe is going to talk to us about the state of Kentucky politics before this big Senate race coming, but also Joe and I went to college together. We've known each other for a while. You've done this podcast before. I always thought you were a good writer, liked you. I think you're the best person to follow for political news in Kentucky, at Joe Sonka. But you also were the first person who told me you thought Donald Trump would win. And you said that in like 2015 and you meant it. And then it ended up being true. So you've got a pretty good record of predictions there.
Well, that was one.
But that was one that no
just
one.
Got luckier. I got lucky or unlucky, depending on your.
No one was on your side. It's certainly not. I mocked you and you ended up being right. So let's start. I want to go over a few things. I want to go over what happened in Louisville for the last 2 or 3 weeks. And then I want to talk a little bit about the Senate race that is tomorrow. But I mean, the last 3 weeks have seen an unbelievable amount of news in Louisville with the protest on the Breonna Taylor and then the David McAtee killing, police chief resigned. Greg Fisher, the mayor, feels like has lost support across the board.
All amid a pandemic. Yeah.
All amid a pandemic. It feels like to me the fundamentals of Louisville, the entire government political scene have changed. I don't know if it'll be permanently, but certainly in the short term. Do you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. I think when you talk about Louisville, it'll be pre-Breonna Taylor and post-Breonna Taylor, probably. Greg Fisher won re-election with he won by like 25%, maybe probably more than 25%. And right now, that coalition that he built is not really there anymore. You see a lot of people on the left, basically calling on him to resign for the past 2 weeks. You've got people on the right calling for him to resign for like the exact opposite reason, that he's not cracking down on protesters. So there's like, there's not much, there aren't many people still passionately defending Greg. It's either, you know, either people on the right or people on the left are taking shots at him. And, you know, I mean, say what, I mean, he, it's basically also, it just made it so much worse how he handled this for the first week or so, where he just refused to, he didn't meet with anyone. He was like hiding somewhere. He had no idea where he was. So, you know, a lot of mayors and a lot of leaders in cities were going out and talking to people protesting. And he wasn't there, but, you know, peaceful protesters were getting shot with pepper bullets and tear gassed. And that kind of set the tone for the week to come in Louisville. And then you had the David McAtee shooting, which is just, it's just kind of mind blowing that you have all these protests downtown, and then all of a sudden you have cops and the National Guard descending on a place in the way out in the West End, because people are congregating. And then you have people rushing a building and shooting pepper balls. And just a kind of a mind blowing decision to make there. And of course that led to the death of David McAtee. And of course we'll know much more about that as that gets further investigated. But that's,
well, let's go back
just
to
an amazing decision.
Let's go back to the Breonna Taylor thing. You know, they've now fired one of the three police officers, Brett Hankison. But no criminal charges yet. That's in Daniel Cameron's office right now. Are you getting a sense? I mean, obviously, I don't expect that you necessarily have sources within Daniel Cameron's office, but I sort of believe that the likely result of this is that these three officers are not charged. That's kind of my, and let me just say, that's not just me being pessimistic about the world. I actually think there is a legal argument that is going to make it difficult to charge them. What is your take on it?
Well, I'll just say that I will be surprised if Cameron charged them. And I'm not saying that based on any internal, you know, things that people have told me from his office or anything like that. But I would be surprised just based on, you know, the nature of how difficult it is in America to actually charge police officers for murder or any serious crimes. And, you know, especially in Cameron's case, Cameron was, you know, endorsed by just about every law enforcement group in the state when he ran for attorney general. He's, you know, held himself up as an ally of prosecutors and police. And I think, you know, we'll see what he does. But I think politically, if you look at this coldly politically, I guess I'd be surprised if Cameron actually filed charges like murder or something that serious. But I mean, we'll let them do their investigation. We'll see. I would just be surprised.
Brett Hankison, when they let him go, the letter said that you know, they had to give a reason for the dismissal. And it said you showed extreme indifference to human life, which is an interesting phrasing of words, because that is a phrasing of words that not only has meaning in terms of the context of firing an officer, it also has a legal meaning. And it is the same words you would use for some form of a manslaughter charge or something like that. Been a while since I studied those codes, but it's one of those phrases. You think that was intentional?
I think they, I mean, you would probably know better than me as someone who went to Duke Law School, but and that was a really strongly worded letter. In fact, it was a lot stronger than I thought it would be. I thought it would just be the, you know, you've violated certain things you were supposed to do. And you know, by the following the book, we have to let you go. But that was about as scathing a letter as you could possibly make. I don't know if, there's going to be, you know, manslaughter, murder, or no charge at all, but based on that letter, the letter was much stronger than I
thought. It was interesting to me because there's apparently 22 shots that were taken. They said in that letter he took 10 of them, which would mean 12 between the other two.
Right.
It's odd to me that they would fire one not fire the other two yet, say extreme indifference to human life, which I think is a legal term at its core. And then part of me wondered, Joe, if it, this is what I felt cynically, and I don't know if this is true, but they felt like the police were like, we've got to do something because these three officers are still being paid. Mm-hmm. Brett Hankison has become known because of these other things, which are these allegations of these sexual assault issues. Do you think that maybe it's just hard for me to see how you fire one and not the other two, unless he took all the shots, which he didn't. Right. I wonder if the past stuff had something to do with it. Have you heard anything about that?
I would be guessing.
Well, I don't want to make a guess, but
yeah. I don't know if other two officers were closer to the shot that was fired from Kenneth Walker, and he was just shooting wildly outside. That's the investigation's going to find that out, but I would just be guessing.
They did not say this. I will do it since, you know, Joe is a responsible journalist, so he has to be careful what to say. I do wonder if they found out that his bullet was the one that hit her, maybe. Maybe that's
eight bullets, so there would have to be.
And maybe if they were all eight his, that's why you have, I mean, I don't know, but that's why you might have. It's just odd to me that you would put one officer there and use that strong language, like you said, and then not with the other officers. It will be interesting to me when the investigation is over to find out that dichotomy, because it has to be a strong one.
And we don't know who fired all the bullets that went into the other apartment said that were just fired wildly. So maybe that was part of it.
Talk for people that are listening to this in the other parts of the state about the citizens of Louisville and their view of the police department in general. I mean, this isn't something that happened in a vacuum. This is something that did you feel like that it was kind of waiting for a moment for there to be this frustration?
I mean, for probably the past 50 years, honestly. I mean, ever since since the 1960s, when you had the first real race riot in 1968, you had huge racial tensions in the 1970s with busing there. I think there've been incidents over in the years, and it's just kind of been building and building. And you had what's happened in Louisville. It's not just, you know, George, it was George Floyd right on top of learning about Breonna Taylor. And then right on top of that, David McAtee. So it's just been a bunch of different factors all combining at the same time to really bring everything to the surface. And we don't know where how this is going to play out, over the next few weeks, few months. We don't know what's going to happen with the officers, and if there's no charges, what's going to happen after that. But everyone's really, really on edge, I would say, in the city right now.
Yeah, and I wonder about that. Okay, so let's say the three officers end up not getting charged, because that to me is the most likely scenario. Probably the second most likely scenario is they only charge Hankison and use the language of the police thing for maybe a manslaughter charge or something like that. I'd be very surprised if all three of them get charged. On some level, we're guessing. But do you worry that we'll have another round of not just protests, but the issues we had if that happens? Or do you think time sort of will not minimize, but time will deflate the response a little?
If there are no charges, I don't think anything will be deflated by then. I mean, whether that's 2 weeks or 3 weeks, I think everything that you've, all the emotions that you've seen over the past few weeks, I think those are going to come back and probably multiply those if there are no charges. But I mean, they're all of the protests and the marches, wasn't just around having one officer fired. They wanted full accountability. Mm-hmm. And if they don't get what they view as justice, then I think you're going to see the same thing happening after that. And what form that takes, I don't know, but we'll see.
Yeah, I understand. Well, let's talk about Daniel Cameron, because I mean, you know, Daniel Cameron for the last year really was a story more as a political story, right? He's a former protege of Mitch McConnell, first African-American elected to a statewide office, young, Republican, handsome. Like, I mean, they're already, Donald Trump's tweeting he's going to be a national political star. I mean, he was almost sort of looked at more as the political figure than anything personal. And now all of a sudden he's the head law enforcement officer in the state. And you're talking to somebody who, I've gotten to know him a little bit. I think he's a nice guy, but he had almost no experience when he took the job. Like not even practice. He had no prosecutorial experience and very little experience practicing law. Now all of a sudden this is just in his lap, and you got Beyonce tweeting him. You got LeBron tweeting him. Like all of a sudden this kid, and he's 32 years old, this kid is in the center storm of one of the biggest decisions that's going to be made in this state in a long time. What do you know about him? What are you hearing? Maybe not about what he's going to decide, but just what do you think about him being now this central figure in it?
Well, it shows the power of having a really powerful mentor who wants you to be in the top law enforcement position in the state. I mean, McConnell basically just cleared the field for him. In the AG race, he got one candidate out. I guess that was late 2018.
Whitney Westerfield.
When Westerfield was going to run, he got him out there, and then another state senator decided he was going to run too, and primary Cameron, and then all of a sudden Cameron, all these dark money groups are putting in attack ads, just shooting him down, and Cameron wins easily. That's a lot of, Cameron will, it's a lot of the people who've kind of described Cameron or asked what he's like, they lead their answer the same way I did, by saying, well, he's Mitch McConnell's, appointed guy. Mm-hmm. And they tend to answer things like, well, what does McConnell want? Does McConnell want this? Does McConnell want that? And I don't think he's really identified himself to people as his own, his own kind of
office
holder who has his own priorities. That people usually just think, McConnell wants this and this this situation, so you can expect Cameron to probably do this. So I don't know. He's still kind of an unknown to me, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I mean, I've spent a little time with him, and he's hard to know a little bit. And this is going to be a defining decision, maybe of his entire career, his entire life.
Definitely. We'll know a lot more about him after,
And it's interesting with both him and Andy Beshear. And I guess we'll switch a little bit gears to Andy Beshear and the governor. You know, these dudes haven't even been in office very long, and all of a sudden they get confronted with an unbelievable set of circumstances. And I think about Andy Beshear, he'd been in office 3 months, and he gets, I would argue, the most difficult situation for a governor of Kentucky since the civil rights movement. When you combine the COVID and these protests, it feels like when he first started, he had universal support. It's gone down. I don't know if it's universal, but I still think he has certainly majority support and probably a high majority, as he's had to make decisions that make a lot of people not happy. How do you think he sort of navigated the whole COVID situation?
No, I think he had a lot of goodwill at the beginning. I think a lot of that is eroded away. There used to be, everyone would tune in at 5 o'clock to see Andy. And if you look at the number of people watching, it's like going way, way down. There's not a whole lot of people watching.
Does he still do it? I didn't know he still did it.
He doesn't do it every day now. He does it, I think he's doing it like 3 days a week.
Okay.
But I think a lot of the reason why some of that support is kind of waning away has to do with unemployment and what a mess it's been for people trying to
explain to people why that's been such a mess. Because I think it's hard for people to understand. Do you know why it got so screwed up?
Well, I think a lot of people gave him the benefit of the doubt for the first month, maybe the first 2 months, because this all landed in his lap. There were like 12 people processing unemployment claims, and then all of a sudden,
60,000.
You've got like 600,000 people filing for unemployment in 1 week, and you have to process all of these. So I think for the first month or two, people gave him the benefit of the doubt. He's because he's got trying to hire more workers. Then, you know, the system wasn't set up for taking this many people. But I think after like 3 months go by, and it still takes 2 months to speak to a human being, to get a reply to an email, to talk to a person. Meanwhile, your bills are piling up. I mean, that kind of thing, I think eventually you reach a point where you can't blame, you know, Matt Bevin for getting rid of staff and offices on unemployment. Eventually you have to step up and say, okay, everything's messed up. We need to fix this now. And I think it kind of reached that point last week, basically. Well, when you had those huge lines.
I have a different question. Do we know what happened? I mean, I was told, and again, this is not official, I was kind of told through a source that the people that were in that line, those people that have had forever, is that a lot of that problem was the people that applied those first couple days, that maybe there was an error that caused the system to lose vast majorities of those. Because most of the people that didn't get it, if you look at it, are like first 2 day filers. Have you heard anything like that? I mean, have you heard what went wrong?
Not specifically. I mean, Bashir says that this is basically a computer system that is basically like a decade old to begin with, that it came in. And then part of the reasons that they can't process claims is because if one person does one thing wrong, then it's impossible to fix it without a huge process that involves a lot of time. And that might be true, but eventually you have to realize that, okay, we need to completely scrap what we're doing and try something new. And if your bills are piling up and you've been waiting for 3 months on something that you've filed, you don't really care about what Matt Bevin did in 2018.
I still think old people still really like Andy, though. Like, it's a weird scenario. I think maybe because they watch it, you know what I mean, on TV every day. But I'll be interested to see the next time there's like an approval rating thing come out, because I still think it's probably pretty high, especially being a Democrat in a Republican state. It's not 80 or 70, but I bet it's probably still high 50s or low 60s.
Yeah, you might be right. I think it might still be above 50, which is saying a lot for a Democrat in this state. I mean, that would be pretty amazing to have over 50% approval almost split in this state.
Let's switch gears for a second to the Senate race. So I'm obviously an interested party in the U.S. Senate race.
Oh, you? Really? And who do you agree for, Matt?
Well, I want to kind of walk with you through the whole thing. Okay, so I want to walk with you through the whole Booker McGrath thing. And let's start with 6 weeks ago, 7 weeks ago. It looked to me like Amy McGrath was going to win handily. I thought there would be more votes for Booker and Breuer than people thought, just kind of as a protest vote, sort of the way that Goforth got a lot of votes against Bevin. But I didn't think there was any chance anyone could win. I thought she'd probably get like 65 or 70 and the other two would split the others. Was that what you thought 7-8 weeks ago?
Yeah, because I don't think anyone really, I mean, very many people knew who Charles Booker was or Mike Breuer was. You know, their name ID was like very, very low. We're talking like less than 20% of, you know, Democrats knew who they were. And just based on that alone and the amount of money that McGrath was spending, I mean, I just didn't think it was going to be any kind of contest at all. And, you know, and then everything happens around late May and early June. You know, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, David McAtee, and you see Charles Booker stepping up and going right in the middle of that and, you know, speaking his mind. And a lot of people said, well, that guy looks like a leader. You know, I like that guy. And a lot of people looked at Amy McGrath and was like, well, what are you doing? I don't really hear from you. So I think that was really the genesis of it. And during that same time, Booker's, you know, political donations went through the roof. So he actually had money to put ads on television. So now a lot of people are actually, you know, seeing him for the first time. People who don't, you know, follow politics as closely as me and you, they see ads and, you know, they see stuff online. And so, the only question I have right now on who wins is if that all happened
too late,
too late for Booker to really
So if everybody were to show up, let's just say that there had been no early voting, and let's say it was a normal process and everybody showed up tomorrow. You think Charles Booker would win if that was the scenario?
I don't know if he would win, but it would be close. I think anytime a candidate spends as much as Amy McGrath has, it's almost impossible to lose. It's almost impossible to lose. And that's one of the things, even though if you look at social media, if you look at the energy and enthusiasm around candidates, you would think, well, Booker's obviously going to win this thing. But if you look at just the amount of advertising, mailers, TV, radio that she's put out there, it's extremely hard to lose an election. The only way you can lose an election is if people do not like you.
People like her. I mean, it's interesting. You mentioned radio. She spends an absurd amount of money with my radio show. Like, she buys if you listen on iHeart, if you're based in Kentucky, she buys every commercial break. So the entire commercial break is an Amy McGrath ad.
Yeah. In Lexington, before 60 Minutes aired, there was like 2.5 minutes of ad time, and they were all 3 different Amy McGrath ads.
Yeah. It's unbelievable.
It's everywhere.
So what was the moment in this that you realized, oh, wait a minute, maybe this is a race? Was there a particular thing that happened that you were like, wow, this is real?
Yeah, when I was on my last furlough, I guess it was the first week of June, it was getting to the end of that. And, you know, I know Twitter isn't real life and everything like that, but it was just odd that every single person
everyone was just talking about
Charles Booker. And I thought, well, you know, I rarely kind of see that, especially in a race where, you know, he's kind of the underdog and no one expects him to really, compete with McGrath. It just got to like a crescendo, and then you had everything happening in Louisville, and you saw him stepping up and people were praising him for that. And I was like, you know, this might actually be a race. That's why it was around that time I was like, hey, if there are any pollsters out there that want to, you know, make some noise, look at Kentucky, you might actually find something interesting here. Because I didn't know whether this was, you know, some kind of social media echo chamber happening, or if something was really going on.
You know, I was debating, I'll be honest, I don't think I've talked about this before, but I was trying to debate in my head whether or not I was going to, I mean, I always knew I was going to vote for him, but whether or not I was going
to. You regret not running now after seeing all this?
No, because I think it had to be him in that moment. I mean, there might have been a path for me to do it, but it wouldn't have been his path, right? Like, I don't. I mean, history's when a man meets a moment. He was the man for that moment. Not me. Like, I don't think people would have rallied.
He was authentic. He was authentic in that movement where Matt Jones came to.
It's not going to be the same. Yeah. I mean, if I'm out there, I think people would maybe give me more benefit of the doubt than Amy, but they still would be kind of looking at me like, Matt Jones is out here walking the streets of Louisville. Like, it's a different, you know, it's just, it's a different thing. So I'm not saying there isn't a path I could have done, but it would have been that path. But there came a point I was trying to decide whether or not I was going to sort of go public with it, because I've never done that in a local race. And it was that I ended up doing it on a Sunday, and I decided on Friday I was going to do it because I was watching him speak outside, and I heard Amy's answer at that debate where she was like, I actually think, to me, I was talking to the campaign. They say there are 4 moments they think changed it. I don't know if they want me to say this, but I'll say it. Number one was when the legislators endorsed them as a group, because it made like Kentucky people go, what's going on? Why would they all do that?
Yeah.
Number two was the debate video where she didn't answer, where she said, like, I didn't protest because I was with my family or something.
It wasn't a good answer.
Not a good answer.
It did not look good. It did not look good.
Number three were what they call the local endorsements, me, the Herald, the Courier, kind of the, like, that's sort of like, okay, something's happening here. And then number four may have been the online boom that maybe culminated in her terrible tweet about healthcare and all that.
Yeah.
That seems like a good run to me. And then nationally, they got huge booms from Bernie and AOC helping them raise money. Does that feel like a good look of it to you?
Yeah. I think it wasn't like an overnight thing. It was it was kind of building over a matter of weeks. I think it was building a little before everything happened in Louisville.
I agree with that. I think it was coming.
It wasn't overnight. It was building a little bit, and then that happened, as I said, like everything that's happened over the past 3 weeks is a lot bigger than, you know, politics and electoral politics and elections. But if you look at it from that perspective, it was just the timing of it was just as he was starting to take off.
George Floyd was killed, I believe, on a Monday. I met with Charles the day before at Heine Brothers here in Louisville and said, well, what do you think if I endorsed you? But I'll be honest with you, in my mind, I was thinking, Matt, you're going to do this. It's not going to make any difference. But like, you're taking a stand for all the crap that she did back in the day. And because I really believe in Charles. And then everything changed on that Monday, Tuesday. And he really, to his credit, I thought did an excellent job of sort of, you know, the Louisville movement didn't have a face of a leader. I think, Joe, I don't know that who it would have been. And he kind of was able to maybe not be the complete leader, but a face of it.
Yeah, I think it is kind of a leaderless movement still. I don't think Charles Booker is a leader of whatever's happening in Louisville. I think he's definitely one of the leaders. Who a lot of people think is authentic and mm-hmm. you know, is someone to listen to. And someone who, you know, didn't, you know, go read a poll on what he should do when this was happening in Louisville. He just stepped up and did it. You know?
I've noticed his, and I'd be interested to see what you think, because I've traveled with him. And I say that I think his strength is when he speaks to a crowd, I think because of what you're saying, his authenticity, the crowd is almost rooting for him. Like, he's a good speaker, but he's not a dynamic speaker. He's not a take the crowd by the palm of his hand speaker. But I watch crowds watch him, and they're almost cheering him on. I think because that he's an authentic person, they want him to do well. So that's why I think I've seen a lot. That's sort of my notion of what his strength is. What do you think his strength is?
So you saw, well, can I ask you a question here?
Of course,
You traveled with him in a lot of rural places, and the kind of crowds he got, do you think that those were kind of like the you know, because every county, even though it's a red county, has liberal people in them who vote, but are they, do you think there are, it's more than just those people that show up? It's
I do.
How do you think he's going to do in those rural areas?
I think he's going to do better than people think. Now, again, what I don't know is, here's what we don't know. When we go to Bowling Green and there's 250 people there, which is what it was, are those the 250 Charles Booker fans?
Exactly.
I mean, I don't know. But I will say this, that the 250 people that are there are passionate about him. They're not just there because it's the Democratic event, and they aren't the regular folks. So part of the reason, Joe, I was going to introduce him is that the local officials are kind of hesitant to introduce him, right? They're not. So the local officials in these, Audrey Hayden in Bardstown was there, but she may have been the only local Democrat official that really came out for him. I think the others are too scared. So I actually think it's a different crowd. I mean, I was saying this on the bus. These did not look like, you know, I haven't done a ton of local Democratic events, but I've done some, and you kind of know the blueprint of a county Democratic voter. That's not what this was. These were kids. These were, you know, we went to E-Town, and there were a lot of people in E-Town and a lot of young people. So what I don't know is, this is not the Democratic establishment, but does that mean they're voting for McGrath and they didn't come? I just don't really know. But I do think he draws crowds, Joe, that are not your average go to a political rally crowd.
Right. And I mean, I think the McGrath campaign, I think they assume that they're going to clean up in most rural areas because of her name ID, because they may think of her as more of a moderate Democrat, and Democrats in rural areas are more moderate. And, you know, they might be right. They might be wrong. I wish there was more polling in this race.
Me too.
Independent polling in this race that I could have an idea. You know, we're going to find out soon enough. And, you know, if she does do well in rural areas, you know, that could mean a win for her, or, you know, Louisville has record turnout and that they haven't seen since, you know, the Barack Obama primary in 2008 2008, and there are so many votes there that, that Booker is able to go across the finish line and just barely, you know, beat her. So we'll find out.
I will say this. I've not seen a candidate in Kentucky draw the excitement out of crowds like he does. I'm not, I mean, I don't know what crowds Allison Grimes or Andy Beshear drew, or, you know, I didn't really go with them, but I'll tell you this, I don't think they were as into it, you know, and
was it like KSR remote?
You know what? That's not a bad, I'll tell you what, that's not a bad sort of analogy, because when people come to a KSR remote, they're a fan of ours and they want to have a good time. They want to, so like they laugh harder at our jokes than they really are funny because people want it to be good. You know what I mean? That's what I got with the sense with this is people want, they want this to be real. And so they're into it. It's not an obligation to come see Charles. It's I'm excited to see Charles.
Yeah.
You know, you've been on a lot of rallies. Yeah. He does a selfie line.
Is a different. Booker is kind of a very different statewide Democratic candidate than people are used to. Like Edlin was pretty left last year, but not quite Booker, you know?
But I mean, when's the last time you've been to a political rally where when it's over, again, it's like a KSR remote, people stand in line to take selfies with Charles like that.
Yeah.
I don't know that people did that with other ones, maybe, but
I've only seen that with like Rand Paul, honestly.
Okay. I could see that. Yeah.
And a lot of people, I mean, there are a lot of similarities and differences between that 2010, that first primary of Rand Paul against Trey Grayson, where he was the underdog running against the big party establishment, and nobody thought he had a chance, and then on election day, he wins by 20 points. I don't know if Booker's going to necessarily do that, because there are certain things that, you know, Rand Paul had in his favor that Booker doesn't. Like Rand Paul had his father's network. He had, you know, he would go on Alex Jones' show and raise a bunch of money.
Before
people knew who Alex Jones was. So I don't know if it's going to be the same kind of thing. That was probably the last primary where I saw like extreme amount of grassroots energy, because every Rand Paul event you went to in 2010. It was just packed full of excited.
Really?
You
know, is that right?
Republicans. Yeah.
I could see that. Well, all right. So the argument, you know, Joe Biden won the Democratic primary in part because he made the argument, I got the best chance of beating Trump. And everybody wants to beat Trump so much. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we'll just vote for him. I think part of Amy McGrath's argument for a long time was, I'm the candidate with the best chance to win. These two far left guys, Breuer and Booker, can't win. I just don't know if people believe that's true anymore. And if your argument is best chance to win and people don't believe you can win, doesn't that hurt? You feel like that's happened at all?
Yeah. Well, I mean, let's look at that last poll that came out. And I don't know how reputable this poll is. It's the Civics came out with a poll last week.
Mm-hmm.
And they've never polled statewide in Kentucky. They do poll a lot of races, but they polled like kind of a funky kind of online methodology to it. And they found that, you know, they found Booker beating McGrath, but they also found McGrath losing by 20 points in a potential matchup with McConnell, and Booker, you know, losing by like 14 or so. So him doing better. And I don't know if that poll is complete garbage if it's the real deal, but I don't know of a lot of people that think McGrath has a great chance of winning against McConnell. No, Booker either, honestly.
No, I mean,
I don't know if I
don't think so. But think about it like this, Joe. What's the percentage vote you think Trump gets this fall?
In Kentucky, I'd say
60.
I'd say around 60. Okay.
50, so just for sake of numbers, let's say 60. Mm-hmm. Almost everybody that goes to vote is going to vote in that race. Is that fair? I mean, you're not going to go vote this fall and not vote for president.
Sure.
So that means to win, you've got to find 10% of the people to vote Trump, you.
Right.
I actually think, and maybe I'm crazy, there's an argument there are more Trump Bookers than Trump McGraths at this point.
Well, but McGrath, you know, McGrath said she was there to protect Donald Trump from.
Do you think that will be
blocking her agenda? I mean,
if she loses, will we look back at the first day as what did it to her?
I mean, it was the most ridiculous strategy. I mean, the strategy was basically saying like, like, I think you're dumb. I think even her supporters like look back and say, yeah, that wasn't really good. But I mean, how, I mean, it's hard to look people in the eye and say, yeah, Mitch McConnell's just blocking Donald Trump's agenda so much. I'm going to be there to make sure he, I mean, it's hard to make that argument on a straight face to people and then have people like take you as being authentic and serious. And that's why you know, she stopped making that argument after a while.
Yeah. I mean, it was an absurd argument. It does.
But it was her opening argument. That was her debut appearance on national television.
You think they just took for granted they would have the nomination, so they were already doing their general election argument?
Oh, definitely. They assumed.
But isn't that odd? Because at that point, when they did that, I hadn't decided. Rocky hadn't decided. Yeah. Forget Breuer and Booker, who came along later. I mean, there were still people considering. That makes it so arrogant.
Well, I think they knew that they were going to have so much money that they were going to scare you all out of the race.
Okay.
Which it did, didn't it?
Well, she didn't scare me out because of money. But I mean, but that was certainly part of it. I mean, there's a part of it that you sit there and you have to say, okay, what's your path to victory? You know, I encouraged Charles to run even if I ran, because my theory was, look, there needs to be a progressive in the race. You can do it. You will have a forum that you can't buy. Go for it. Now, I have to tell you, Joe, I didn't think he'd have a chance to win. And I legitimately think he has a chance to win now. So it might be, if she loses, is it one of the all-time worst collapses of a candidate that you can think of?
If you look at it dollar for dollar, and I haven't had time. I was actually, this was on my to-do list of going back and seeing who was the candidate to lose that had the biggest money advantage ever in an American election. And I would have to think she would be in the running, because she's raised over $40 million.
Man. That's unbelievable.
$40 million. And in the first 3 months of this year, Booker raised like, what, $400,000 or so? Or something like less than that. I think it was $300,000 in the first 3 months. And he had less than $1 million going into June 1st, I think. So I mean, just a 40 million to one advantage.
Unbelievable.
Like, you just don't see that in politics, and that's one of the reasons why I'm thinking who's going to win this race. I keep going back to, well, I mean, McGrath she physically can't lose. You can't have that much money and spend that much money and lose.
You know, Steve Bannon, though, Joe, not to quote Steve Bannon in a Democratic primary, but Steve Bannon makes a statement that I actually think is true. That we've reached a point that because media is everywhere, maybe money doesn't matter exactly the same. Yep. You still have to find your stage. And if you don't find a stage, money matters. But if you can find a stage, it doesn't matter as much. Do you think that's plausible?
If McGrath loses, then yes. I think you've proven that right there. I think money still matters in, you know, the very, very, very large majority of races. But I think it would show that money can't buy everything. And if you know, the foundation of your campaign is if you don't have any solid foundation to your campaign, then all the money in the world is not going to be able to save you. I think what I said a while ago is if the only reason that the only way that tons of money propping you up, you know, can fail is if people just genuinely don't like you.
Yeah.
And if all of your ads are positive, like I'm a great person, and it doesn't connect with people, then, you know, that's obviously,
You know, what's interesting, when I hear any McGrath ad or any McGrath statement, most of it's about Mitch McConnell. Right. Like, I mean, her biggest argument is, I am not Mitch McConnell.
Yes.
Booker is not like that. Like, Booker can speak for 45 minutes and almost not even mention Mitch McConnell. His sort of, this is what I want to see happen. Rarely, like, I honestly, in the intros for Charles, talk more about Mitch than he does in his speech. I actually think that's interesting, because that was a good point you said about what the foundation of your campaign is. I think her foundation has just been, well, I'm not him. Mm-hmm. And he has a foundation that's different than that. And maybe that's why people gravitate to it.
Yeah, maybe. Or this is all wrong and McGrath is going to win by, you know, 15 points.
So what's the most likely scenario then? Like, so let's all right, let me give you five scenarios. Which one's most likely? McGrath wins by a lot. McGrath wins by little. It's like almost tied. Booker by a little, Booker by a lot. What's the most likely scenario? What's the least likely to you?
I'll give you the two most likely.
Okay.
I don't know which one it'll be. The two most likely, one of these two, it will be, you know, McGrath wins by a small kind of embarrassing amount, but she moves on to the general against McConnell. Two is it's close. Ballots aren't counted for another week, and there are legal challenges for the next 2 months over who's the Democratic nominee to take
over. You see a close race then, kind of. You don't see a scenario where
I don't see a blowout.
Yeah.
I don't see a blowout. I think it'll be close. I think one of the reasons why I tend to still think that probably McGrath is going to win is that so many people sent in their absentee ballots early before all this happened.
Yeah.
I'll give the example. I'll embarrass her here, but my mother is a Democrat, registered Democrat. She got her absentee ballot like as soon as possible, right as well. Mm-hmm. Sent it back in like the next day with McGrath, and you know, then fast forward like a month later, she's like, "Oh, I really wish I would have voted for."
I think people believe. I think there's. I think there are a lot of those people. I think from what I've heard, sort of some internal numbers, there are people that believe that those people like your mom went like 80% for McGrath. Those like early earlies, the like, I got to get it in as quickly as possible.
And I would probably believe that. Yeah.
And that could be too much. I will say, you know, I spent the day with McGrath's campaign. With Booker's campaign. What's interesting about it, Joe,
that would be something if you spent the day with McGrath's campaign.
That's unlikely to happen. It's striking when you're around them, a couple things, how young they are, mm-hmm. how they're drinking from a water hose, like meaning like, this just kind of all hit them. And they're hanging on for dear life. You know,
I feel, I don't mean this to criticize them or diminish what they've done, but I feel like they're kind of like riding this wave that, you know, they might not have created, but it's kind of taken over and pushed them this far. Because I'm not sure if even they would have expected this like a month ago.
No, I don't think so. But you know, here's the thing. And they brought in a couple national people that I actually think are really smart. Like I got to know them a little bit on the thing, but here's the thing. They're like kind of, again, drinking from a water hose, but I think in some ways their lack of sort of normal political thought process has helped them. Mm-hmm. Like, as McGrath's people are so political and they're a little different, I actually think that contrast has kind of worked for them, you know, maybe in the way it did for Trump in the Republican
primary. I was about to say that. Yeah. That was one of the reasons I think I talked to you in 2015 was that every politician had become a series of talking points and they were all saying the same thing and he was saying something different. It was something, you know, completely but it was different and it got people's attention and they actually listened to them because they weren't quite sure what he was going to say. It wasn't going to be talking point A followed by talking point B.
You'd be surprised how many people in the mountains that I talk to or that are KSR fans are Republicans and are like, you know, I might vote for Charles Booker in the fall. Now I don't know if they will, but it's just that they like that difference about him, because the thing they like the least about Mitch is what you just said, that sort of he is the epitome of politician. And, you know, we'll see. All right. So before I let you go, Biden, Trump, I'm sure I'll have you on again before the general election, but where are you on that? It looks really good for Joe Biden. Do you think it stays like that?
I'm not ready to make that prediction that I made last time. I'm really still not quite sure what's going to happen. It's like we have a new, you know, historic event happening every month or two now. So whatever the next catastrophic historic event is in, you know, August is going to probably determine the winner. So too soon to tell for me.
If Matt Bevin was sort of an indicator to the country of Donald Trump coming.
Then that would mean Biden, right?
Andy Beshear in a lot of ways was like, okay, we don't want any more of that. It's just too much. Let's get some boring guy in here. Well, isn't that Joe Biden? I mean, isn't that kind of the same thing?
Right. Yeah, that's kind of the America 1 year behind Kentucky model that's worked since 2014, 2015, I guess.
Yeah, we are certainly. Well, let me finish by saying, just on a personal level, congrats on the Pulitzer Prize. It's well-deserved. But I also want to just say congrats on what you have built up. I mean this when I say that people tell me that they get all their political news kind of from following your Twitter account. And I knew when you were working for these alternative, you know, organizations and kind of grinding, I'm really proud of you, like of what you've accomplished, and you got to be happy about it.
Well, I appreciate it, Matt. Yeah, it's kind of hard to believe sometimes where I'm at, but keep this going as long as I can.
All right. Well, thank you for coming on.